Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network. Today's guest is Ili Barakhtari, the president and CEO of the Special Competitive Studies Project and one of the world's leading experts on artificial intelligence. His experience in the White House and heading the National Security Commission on AI has made him central to the conversations at the cross-section of national security, intelligence, and government. At a time when AI is experiencing exponential growth, Barakhtari praises the U.S. for leading on innovation, but he also issues a dire warning that the U.S. must take big steps to stay ahead of China and maintain its information dominance. He says that the first nation to master AI supremacy will hold a significant strategic advantage. He calls for the DoD to be combat ready by 2025, noting that the next battlefield militaries will have great difficulty hiding from and surprising one another. Ili, thanks for joining us.
First, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. We at the SCSP are a big fan of your podcast and everything you're doing to, you know, expand the knowledge and network of AI in DC. I think we're living at the time when DC needs more education and efforts in bringing up the speed, the decision making and policy makers on the conversation around AI. The Special Competitive Studies Project grew really out of the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence. And the background story to this is that when we were getting at the close of the National Security Commission on AI, NSCI, which—
And who called for that, by the way? What's the history?
Yeah. So that's a really good question, Tammy. Like, when you look in hindsight, everything makes more sense sometimes. But in 2018, I think our Congress was really concerned with two factors. Number one is everything they were hearing from Silicon Valley, they thought there's a powerful transformational technology coming our way. And I think you can see the early signs of this in, you know, among Silicon Valley founders and big companies that they were testing and playing with this new technology called AI. And then the second factor was when you look back in 2017, 18, and 19, everything China was doing in this space, you could get a sense of why this is such an important technology. You could see a clear sense of the strategy they were coming up publicly. They wanted to be, they said it, that they want to be a global AI leader by 2030. They were putting enormous resources behind their companies. They identified national AI champions among their companies and said, hey, you're my AI champion. You go and run as fast as possible. And so I think our Congress was really concerned with that, with these two factors. What are we doing with AI for the purpose of national security? And I'd like to highlight that the NSCI was not looking at AI for the benefit of humanity mm-hmm. or the economy or education or society. The focus was very narrow because it came from the Armed Services Committee on the Hill. So the focus and the mission was clear. What are our national security agencies doing with AI and what can they do more? Mm-hmm. And so that's how we structured our work. They picked 15 individuals from private sector, academia, and government to be the commissioners. I admit that I didn't know much about the commissions before that. The most famous one is 9/11 Commission that came after the tragic event of 9/11. And they looked at what went wrong and recommended ways to fix those deficiencies. But Congress routinely points like one or two commissions a year. You don't hear for most of them. Ours, I think, came at the critical point because I think when you look back in 2017, you know, we came up with a national security strategy in the Trump White House, and I was fortunate to work for General McMaster, who's the primary author of that document, that called for turning around our policies against China. Up to 2017, our policy for China was seeking their growth and development so they can benefit the overall global commons, global goods, and everything else. But I think in 2017, there was a clear-eyed view that that is not the China we wished for. We got a different China. Was a main competitor to the United States and our system of values and beliefs. And so I think in 2017, you have a massive shift in how we view China from a political, geopolitical order competition. But I think the one piece that the government documents that I've been many, many times witnessed to don't have is the technology piece. Because the government is no longer in charge of technology. That has moved to private sector. That's where the innovation is happening since the end of the Cold War. And so I think with NSCI, we moved and we filled that void. And we produced what I call it a national security document on artificial intelligence. But I mean, you can easily replace the word AI with any other technology that is happening right now because there's some clear deficiencies we have as a society that we have to address. The people piece, the hardware piece, how we're organized, where the money has to go to in terms of basic R&D. And so I think NSCI played a vital role in those 2+ years in providing Congress with the overarching themes of where we have to move. I think the CHIPS Act probably is the most visible act of that effort, because for 3 years we advocated for a massive infusion of resources towards the hardware we lost over the years to China and other countries. Because key component, as you know, in developing these AI models is the hardware. And so we didn't have any more access to that hardware, nor we were producing that hardware. So we recommended, you know, massive infusion of resources towards that hardware buildup in the United States, which I now we see with the execution of the CHIPS Act. So NSCI was really good in terms of like identifying all those deficiencies, I think. We have massive movements on some of them. I think we count more than 50 pieces of legislation that were passed based on that document. And then to the long answer to your question, how we get to the SCSP.
Yeah.
This is the time in the summer of 2021 when Eric was writing his book. Eric Schmidt was writing a book with Dr. Kissinger, The Age of AI. And Dr. Kissinger spoke fondly about this initiative he led in the 50s called Special Studies Project, which basically...
That was for President Eisenhower, right?
So it started first under the Nelson Rockefeller mentorship, but it informed President Eisenhower build-up in terms of not just the military, because people forget that, you know, Eisenhower also created the National Science Foundation,
right.
NASA, all these institutions that actually helped us lead in the innovation, whether it's space or science or all these other institutions. But Nelson Rockefeller tasked Dr. Kissinger in the 50s to look at how we can get ourselves organized against the Soviet Union threat. Now, when you look at these documents from the 50s, and I was fortunate to look at the entire archives of the minutes and everything they've been doing, you know, back in the 50s, we were talking about mutual destruction because Soviet Union reached a nuclear parity with the United States. So it was a complete change of dynamics between us and them. They were going and pressing our alliances. They were investing in countries. They were building their military capabilities. And so it was a really difficult time for our country in the 50s. We were still living through the World War II victory sentiment, how we got over, you know, the Nazi Germany and their allies. But we were not looking at what is the new threat in front of us. And I think the Special Studies Project from the 50s really captured that sentiment. And so Eric came and said, hey, Dr. Kissinger really likes us restarting that initiative. I admit that I didn't know anything about the Special Studies Project from the 50s, that there's not much you can find online because it was from the 50s. And then they published a book that became a bestseller, not widely known, called Prospect for America. 400,000 sold copies. It cost $1.25 in the 50s. I think I paid $99 on Amazon on a good day. Right. I think ever since we launched SCSP, the price has gone up.
Yeah, you're helping them.
Yeah. But the book is really remarkable because when you read it from today's perspective, it provides that thinking in the 50s from our leading policymakers, military officers, of what are some of the things we have to do, not just on the military national security space, but how do we have to organize our educational system? How do we have to organize our economy to combat the vision that the Soviet Union was projecting globally? And so I think that document, as you said, informed the Eisenhower buildup. And I also think that that document really set the foundations for how we built everything during the Cold War to compete against the Soviet Union that we ultimately won. And so Eric was like, should we do this? I drafted a one placemat for Eric. And then I called Bob Work, who's my old boss from the Pentagon. And I consider him as my closest mentors. And I said, hey, sir, we're about to launch this. I would love if you can be part of this. And he said, really, we got to add competitive in the title. I was like, how's that? Why is that? And he said, because in competition, you either win or lose, and we are in a generation competition with China, so we have to win this. So that's why we added competition in our title.
Well, it says action.
It is action. And I also differentiate this from the SSP from the 50s.
Right.
And so SCSP came to fruition at the end of the NSCI. October 1st, we launched SCSP. And it's been 2+ years now. And our goal, as I said in the mission statement that it's available on our website, is really how do we get ourselves organized for a competition that will be so transformative for our society writ large in a time when you face competitors, not just China, but now you see a set of alliances building against the United States and our allies. You have China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran that are really getting much, much closer across all domains to compete and to present a different alternative view to what we present globally. And I think we help in that space because we bring the power of our network, I think that we have. Mm-hmm. We bring the power of the work we have done so far in putting AI and emerging tech at the center of this competition. And I think there's a bipartisan sentiment that exists that right. I think we have.
Don't you think it's stronger today than maybe even a year ago or no?
One argument I make is that there's a lot of political noise in Washington or if you turn on TV around our political system. But when it comes down to a technology competition with China, there's a clear sense of bipartisanship that exists. I mean, if you look at the actions for the last 2 weeks from the China Select Committee against TikTok.
Well, that was going to be my question. What's your take on that?
We've been pretty clear from day one of the SCSP about TikTok and all the platforms coming from what we call countries of concern. Because TikTok is, I think, the first that we're dealing with. But I think there's a set of applications that are waiting in line to become the next TikTok, whether it's in retailing, online shopping, fintech, you name it. But China has deployed globally a set of platforms to dominate our digital life. And I think for the last 2 years, we've been pretty clear on TikTok. We should ban TikTok on two grounds. Number one is it's coming. TikTok is a platform coming from the country that is our main competitor. And it's not a competitor in sort of like a democratic space. It's a competitor that it presents a threat to our political system, economic system, military competition. How are we even allowing a platform that coming from a country like that to operate in our society, number one? So our recommendation has been ban it on a national security grounds. And the second thing is, how is it possible that we allow any platform coming out of China to operate freely in the United States when they don't let any of our platforms or they have banned them in China?
Right.
And as you know, the TikTok that it's allowed to be used in the United States is not the same TikTok that they allowed their teenagers to operate in China. And so reciprocity is big for SCSP. And on those two grounds, we have argued that we should find a modality to either ban or really, as the China Select Committee has said, really have TikTok be divested from ByteDance, which is closely related to CCP.
Okay, so Secretary Mnuchin is putting together a group, and I guess there's other groups forming to buy TikTok. Is that going to help?
So look, the China Select Committee was pretty specific. If they divest, if they cut ties from their main company, which is also related to CCP, if they build data centers in the United States, if they follow United States laws, if there's an American leadership of the company with the American board, that is a completely different TikTok. Now, the challenge you're going to have there is, will China ever allow that? I personally don't think so. Will China ever allow the algorithm to be in the hands of United States citizen leadership and company? I also don't think so, because if you look back 2 years ago, the one thing they placed an export control was on the TikTok algorithm. They just didn't want that algorithm to be in the hands of non-Chinese investors or owners.
So why does Secretary Mnuchin think he can do it?
Because I think the China Select Committee has given a path to TikTok to do the right thing.
Right.
If they want to do the right thing, I think American investors should invest there because they can build a company around U.S. values, U.S. norms. And so I think that's why you have indications from, you know, Secretary Mnuchin and others that they might invest in this next TikTok. But I think we have to see whether TikTok will do that cut with ByteDance and ultimately CCP.
I know you're not a technologist, but if TikTok is on somebody's phone right now, what guarantee do they have if someone else buys it? It doesn't seem like it could be a clean cut. I mean, do you think there is a clean cut there?
The technologists you speak to, they'll tell you that the separation is possible. I mean, if data resides in U.S. and U.S. territories, if data centers are here where you have access to the servers and these data centers, which is controlled by technicians and our guys and probably with some kind of a government oversight in terms of what goes in and out, that is probably possible. But I think first you have to see that separation of TikTok from the main company, which mm-hmm. is ByteDance. And I think then that would be the next step of like how that gets executed. When I was in Australia, you know, some of the conversation we had is they were much more open to these things in terms of like, look, we're never going to get rid of TikTok, but we'll have to find ways to mitigate the risk. and have enough control on like what happens with the Australian citizen data not going over to CCP for online reasons or whatnot. So I think that would be the next step of like, how do we create that arrangement for TikTok to exist here? I would also note that, you know, India, a lot of people complain that these bans will lead to like massive pushback or economic repercussions and whatnot. But India banned almost all the Chinese apps. And I think one of the biggest ones was WeChat, if I'm not mistaken, that had 400 million users in India. And after 2 days, life went on in India without any challenges. But they were able to pull the Band-Aid right away and protect themselves. I worry because the next 5 years will be so difficult in our relationship with China because of their goals and the ambitions and everything around their technological objectives, military objectives, that we should not give China any opportunity to mess up with the minds and the information space.
And the election?
And the election, for that matter, inside the United States.
And do you think that a sale or proposed sale or whatever's going to happen will be resolved before they have an impact on the election?
So as you know, the House passed the bill. Now it's on the Senate and we'll see what happens. But like, look, we're a democracy, Tammy. I'm also a realist in terms of that these things take time. We'll probably go through court cases. We'll see, you know, like first action followed by a counter action. So I would be hopeful to see this before the elections, but realistically, you know, things move in a democracy in a pretty slow way that I think it's much better to do it the right way and have that separation the right way than to rush and have then legal battles continue for many, many years in some uncertainty outcome.
Are any other countries contemplating the same kind of ban?
I think the UK came following us with like they have to relook also the approach based on our approach. But I think there's enough bipartisan consensus right now on both sides against coming up with solutions to address these issues. Not specifically TikTok, export controls and closing any gaps that I think the China Silicon Community has identified in terms of like, you know, deficiencies we have in our organizing principle against China. You got to remember, Tammy, our organizations and institutions will develop for a Cold War competition against Soviet Union, which was primarily a military competition. Our Department of Commerce didn't play a huge role in competition against Soviet Union. But now I think Department of Commerce is centerpiece in competition against China. Look at most of the policies that came up in the last 2 years. They came from Department of Commerce.
Right.
Both in terms of promoting our domestic capabilities in terms of chipset, but also protecting our capabilities through export controls and everything else that we're doing. So we have to go through massive revamp of our institutions because we're facing a competitor that is a full spectrum domain competitor. They compete with us on fintech, economic policies, military policies, technological outreach. If you look at the global 5G map, it's mostly red because we closed our eyes for several years and we allowed China to subsidize Huawei and deploy it globally to countries that didn't have a choice either to take it or they were heavily subsidized to take that infrastructure. So now all of a sudden we woke up in a landscape in which most of the world is using the 5G built and deployed by China. And so we should never allow ourselves to be in a position like that where another technology, we call it get 5G'd in front of us. Because now we live in a period in which these technologies are setting the foundation of our country, of the future of our economy, and the future of national security.
What do you think is the implication of the closer relationship between Russia and China on AI and these issues?
They're doing it by action. If you look at what's happening in Ukraine, they're putting their limitless friendship that they came out with right before the Ukraine invasion. This is the statement. This is a long statement by President Putin and by President Xi on the nature of their relationship. I think they're demonstrating that by doing joint actions in Ukraine, whether or not they're providing each other with capabilities, with spare parts, releasing export controls and trade barriers. North Korea is chiming in there. We know that Iran is providing Shahid drones there. So they are demonstrating their relationship on the ground in Ukraine right now, regardless of their like public rhetoric of not helping each other. But I think we all know by now how they are doing these kind of a jointness on the ground against Ukrainian forces. And so I think, you know, we should just judge them by the action, not right. by, as I always say, this is the battleground we face, not the battleground we wish for. And I think the battleground we face is really these four countries, or as we call it, axes of disruptors, really coming together in terms of trade, economic policies, technological exchanges, because China is really strong on the technology, build, manufacture, and produce. But Russia is really strong in terms of human capacity. So I think there you can see the early results of this cooperation on the ground in Ukraine, but probably elsewhere as well.
I've heard you talk about AI supremacy. Whoever has the best AI, most AI, is going to win. And you still think the U.S. is ahead?
Absolutely.
And how do they get there? I know you're calling for 2025. Let's talk about intelligence and the military. Do you see progress in the U.S. in facing not just China, but all the other countries you mentioned and all the problems? Or are they just moving at the usual pace?
So let me first answer the question about AI supremacy. If you and I lived when electricity was invented, would we say we need to be ahead in electricity? Because if we're not ahead, then others will catch up and surpass us and build their economy and their future based on this new technology called electricity. The story I usually use is, at the beginning of last century, there were candle lighters in New York City. It took people that would go every night and light the streets in New York City. After 5 years with the invention of electricity, that profession disappeared. And I think within 7 years, the union of candle lighters disappeared. So these are massive technological tsunamis that happen once in a generation. You had it with electricity. I think nuclear weapons was probably the second biggest one because our main competitor was developing nuclear weapons. We were developing nuclear weapons for mutual destruction. And I think we went all in. I mean, the whole Oppenheimer movie that now is popular is that it shows that critical mass of our scientists and our military people getting together to come up with the next generation weapon systems because our adversary was rushing ahead. AI, I think, falls into that category. If we don't master AI, we will be behind because our main competitor is rushing ahead. And not just our main competitor. This is now a race for AI of the future because the economy is going to be built on this AI. Our future education will be built on this AI. Our way of life will evolve around AI, and ultimately, our military will use this AI for the purposes of military operation. Now, to your second question about is our intelligence community using it? I believe that we are there in two steps forward, one step backward moment, because every new technology presents a new opportunity for all our government agencies, to include the intelligence community. I think AI will help RIC enormously, because if you look at the massive amounts of data, if you look at the massive amounts of text that RIC deals with, and ultimately the products that they release for policymakers, these foundational models will provide an enormous benefits for our intelligence analysts.
Can you talk about the next battlefield? What does that look like?
Yeah. Well, I think we're seeing the glimpses of that in Ukraine right now. We call it Offset X in one of our documents.
Offset X?
Offset X.
Okay.
Which basically you need three elements for the future of battlefield. You need to dominate software. And our argument is America leads in software. Therefore, our men and women in uniform should lead in software. What we mean by software is AI, data, algorithms. They all have to be set up in a way to work. So when you ask me about what does DoD ready by 2025 mean is that all these systems work. Eventually, you'll get to the point with AI, as you know, Tammy, that it will be in the background, that everything we do is somehow with AI, but you don't talk about it. You don't say, like, see, I'm using AI, but it's there in the background, like electricity. You walk into a room, there's electricity. That's how the future will be. So our argument about AI being ready 2025 is that Department of Defense will be that AI ready. That we don't struggle anymore by saying, hey, we need to buy more software, we need to bring more people, we need to change the procurement systems. It's there and it works. So the software supremacy is one thing. The second piece is, as you see in Ukraine, the future of battlefield is a lot of unmanned, small drones deployed, distributed, talking to each other. I think Ukraine has showcased us how can you achieve battlefield successes by deploying massive amounts of drones. Now, unfortunately, Russia catched up fast because they saw the future and they geared up their domestic industrial base to produce these drones. But I think our system has been for many, many years built on building massive platforms that are now easy targets of these small, cheap platforms. And so I think we have to flip the switch and start building these things on scale, these network distributed platforms that can talk to each other, that can communicate in non-pervasive environments where there's no GPS, and that they can guide our soldiers to the battlefield, because our soldiers don't have to be first in line. You can deploy these systems to do reconnaissance, to give you, you know, a visual of how the battleground looks like. So I think that's the second piece of our Offset X. And the third piece is that we argue strongly is the human machine teaming. We're moving into a space, and I say this personally, the next 3 years, we're going to live in this co-piloting stage. Everything we do will be with these systems. Whether you're a soldier, whether you're an intelligence analyst, if you're a podcaster or a writer or whatever you call it, but the next 3 years, your life will be much easier because you will be working with these models. And so I think we just have to train people that we will do everything to include military operation in this human-machine collaboration and combat teaming. That the man will guide these systems. They'll know more because of these systems. They'll be able to target more because of these systems. But this requires a new way of thinking, new educational opportunities, new training for our men and women in uniform. But the co-piloting stage will really allow us to be better, to be more productive. And then I think we will enter a different stage after maybe these co-piloting stage in which these systems will probably be invalid because they'll be better, they'll be faster, they'll communicate with each other, and we will be able to be there in the background organizing and prioritizing them on what to do.
And will the military be safer because it starts with AI and not individuals?
100%, because like, if our goal is to protect our men and women in uniform, then you will not put them in the first line of the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
You will put them somewhere much, much more in a distance in which, with the help of these systems, they can see forward. They'll be able to strike forward. I think Bob Ward called it see deep, strike deep platforms. And these are cheap platforms. So our men and women in uniform will be able to, hopefully, with these integrated platforms, to use many of these distributed platforms forward to give them the battlefield advantage.
All right, so let's stay on the battlefield for a minute, because on the side, we see Starlink and Elon Musk coming in. Mm-hmm. What are the implications of this private company and private companies like this right in the middle of the battlefield?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the Starlink episode is really what was happening for the since the end of the Cold War, probably, where innovation moved to private sector. Now, as a reminder, because as SESB, I always have to go back to the Cold War, is during Cold War, innovation was happening in government labs. That's where, you know, internet was invented, you know, through DARPA studies and investings. That's where Siri, I think the early models of Siri was invented. But what we have done as a country is when the Cold War ended, we thought that we don't have to make any more government investments in basic R&D. So Congress cut the funding. We went from 2% of our GDP investing in basic R&D through universities and these like startups to like less than 1%. And I think then the innovation shifted to private sector. And you see the explosion since, you know, early 2000s of these like tech companies that invested so much in these platforms. And I think Starlink is a result of that, that finally, you know, an individual with enormous capacity, enormous resources, went and invested in an area that government abandoned probably for years because we went to invest in like large satellite platforms. And we abandoned the launch of satellites completely. And he found a gap in which we have abandoned, invested a lot. And luckily for us, because it's a US company, it proved to be successful. Now we are in this dilemma now in which, you know, war decisions are being put in the hands of a private individual in the United States that has enormous capability. And I think we just have to, as we have said with SCSP, we need a new public-private model in how we operate going forward. I also like to remind most of the time that we're facing a competitor that has a sieve mill fusion. What does that mean? That means that everything that private sector does in China automatically can be in the hands of government. There's no question there. If CCP wants to get a hold of any algorithm, any satellite, any cyber capability, they'll get it within a minute. In our system, that doesn't work. And I'm not arguing that we will beat China ever. This is America. We're different. But we need a different model in how we build a public-private model. And I really think that SCSP wants to build that because I think you cannot have government coming up with AI policies, absence of some kind of a conversation with technology people. Otherwise, we will be developing policies that are not going to stand the test of time because this technology is moving fast. But also, I think we need a whole-of-nation approach to public-private partnership because the private sector in the United States is what's leading in innovation. I'd like to remind everybody that in the last 3 years, two critical innovations came from private sector in the United States. The COVID vaccine and the speed and scale of deployment of COVID vaccine, globally probably, and ChatGPT. These are two inventions that came from our companies, our labs. So we need a different model of how we bring this community together. And that's what we do with SCSP, to be honest, Tammy, every day.
So let's talk about ChatGPT. It comes out and the whole world changes. You guys are aware of it. The Chinese are aware of it, right? These models, these companies that we're seeing now, how do you see, if you can, how can you see their future in terms of how it's used?
Our companies or all the companies?
No, I mean, AI companies now, like NVIDIA, we know where they are, but like OpenAI, Cohere, all these companies.
Yeah.
Are they going to exist?
Yeah. I mean, look, right now, most of these frontier models are concentrated in a handful of companies, as you know, because these models to be built are expensive. You need enormous data. You need enormous resources to build the hardware. And so I think you have a concentration among a handful of companies for these frontier models. There are also enormous resources going right now in AI, as you know. A lot of new companies being built, a lot of new capabilities being built. So I think, you know, I remember somebody said, but like, we will probably see the next big companies being developed in the middle of this, in this era. I don't think we have seen the last of these companies. When you look at Anthropic, for example, came out 2 years ago. Look at where they are now. Tremendous worth that they have, but also one of the, some of the best models we have. Claude 3 was released last week, and some of the early indications are that it's probably as good as, but maybe even better than GPT-4.
What's your take on the open source versus not open
source? Yeah. So I think
black box.
Yeah. So I think right now you have two pathways in terms of these large language models. You have the proprietary models that I think we all are familiar with, and then you have the open source model that was released by Meta. Llama 2 is, I think, the latest model, and I think there are predictions that Llama 3 will be released this summer. I think there'll be space for both camps. And both of them will provide some kind of a added value in the market. Now, I think one challenge we have is, generally, our ecosystem worked because we had the triangle of innovation because of private sector, academia, and government working hand in hand for these things. Right now, the problem we have is that academia doesn't have enough resources to have access to these models. Now, as you know, Congress has worked on establishing the National AI Research and Resource Cloud. I think OSTP with the National Science Foundation are working on the test case for these things. But I think we have to come up with a model in which academia has access to these models.
Do you think it should be?
So I think it has to be two things. Number one is, I think we have to really scale up the NAIR. I think the initial resources dedicated for this are not sufficient.
So that's government.
That's government, because I think that will allow academia, small size entrepreneurs, access to these cloud systems to play and build the next generation innovation systems. But I think the second thing is, one of the things we have argued for is, during the Cold War, for example, we have given government labs, university labs, capabilities to either build protection around nuclear weapons, safety and trust around nuclear weapons, but the government gave them those capabilities. Those capabilities now come in the name of hardware. Like, if you only have the latest and greatest from NVIDIA, you will be able to build these models and test them in terms of safety, in terms of risk. I really think that government should step in and buy hardware for universities. And so then they can test them, evaluate them, and give us the right and left limits on what can these models do. Because otherwise, academia will be left so far behind.
And there's a lot of worry about that.
100%. 100%. Because as I said, these models are really expensive. Hardware is not easy to get to, especially the high-end hardware. But also another angle to this that we have advocated for is, if these export control rules will hurt our companies, and their ability to export to China, then the government should step in and buy this excess hardware and give it to universities. So our companies are not hurt, but also you have distributed this hardware to universities that they have the talent, they have the people, and they're willing to do these things so we can balance the triangle of innovation in our country.
And are you working on that?
Yes. I have a piece coming up, hopefully.
Well, I mean, it does balance things out, yeah, right?
It does. I mean,
because then, to your point, you're going to have small companies with innovation, but there's no way to really scale it unless there's private investment. Yeah. And then for it's all individual as opposed to where universities just elevate everything.
And look, I mean, obviously, it requires a new set of resources from government. And as you know, getting new resources is always difficult. But even Secretary Raimondo argued like a couple of weeks ago that she also foresees a CHIPS Act 2. Mm-hmm. Because I think CHIPS Act 1 was only to jumpstart these capabilities.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean, and it will only get you a lead for a short period of time. It doesn't guarantee you will have that lead forever. Because China is investing enormous resources here. And they're building their domestic capability to really block our companies.
So we've got to make a complete turn here, and we've got to talk about elections, okay, around the world as well as in the U.S., because the power of AI has already been demonstrated. We're not going to go through the details. What do you see as possible fixes?
Before the elections?
Before the elections.
This is a difficult one, because you're racing with a technology that is changing by the day. I mean, you mentioned the release of ChatGPT, but how much and how more advanced these models have become since then, right? November of 2021. So that's one thing. So you're racing with that. Technology is open source. It means it can be in the hands of anybody. State actors, bad actors, non-state actors, right? Most of the democratic world is going through elections, as you know. I think more than billions of people are voting this year in the elections. Here in EU, India, Indonesia, you name it. And we have argued strongly that if you are our adversary, China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, this is your once in a lifetime opportunity to mess up with our social cohesion, to mess up with the democratic system and the outcomes. So what can you do? Number one is you make sure that the institutions we have in place have robust authorities and policies in place to really protect our system as best as possible. And I think this is more from the outside adversary perspective, because we will not close our democratic platforms. You will never be able to close our platforms like Meta and X and Insta from our adversaries, because we are a democracy. And we have seen time and again how they try to circumvent the system, how they build troll farms, etc. So we just have to be better prepared for these elections. I don't think we'll be bulletproof. I think we have to educate our citizens about the risk.
And by the way, how do you see citizens being educated, not just about that, but about AI? Have you seen anything that works?
Taiwan. Taiwan elections were a great model. If you look at Taiwan, the number of cyber attacks they go through daily from China is mind-boggling. I don't have the statistics here with me, but we can send you this afterwards. But they were able, to build a solid election process with an outcome that was legitimate. And they were able to tell their citizens, hey, this is like a complete deepfake media speculation or platform speculation, and this is real. So they worked really hard in educating their citizens. And not to mention their position, it's a really sensitive one. So they got ahead of this, and they produced really strong election outcome. So you can learn from some of these models. You can buy, you can learn from the experiences. I think I always like to believe that we are better off, because I think we have seen now in the past what has happened.
But so we're better prepared. But it feels like, if you look at all the polls today, it seems as people have forgotten all of that. The New York Times had a front page story that all of this disinformation, it works better now than it did in the last election. So what about what OpenAI is doing? They're the only ones that I'm aware of now that have come out and said if AI is used in any of these campaigns, they'll take it down.
In Munich, most of our tech companies announced like Coalition for Election Integrity. There's an organization called TruePic that does a fantastic work in this space. They have a coalition for content provenance and authentication. C2PA is called. But what they do is they work really hard in identifying images and videos that are generated by the models. They might have watermark behind it that says, hey, this is generated by an AI system. This is generated by a human. It's a tremendous coalition and an organization that works on this space. We are a big supporter of TruePic. Mm-hmm. They're going to be at the expo you mentioned earlier. But there are some efforts in this space in terms of, like, you know, if you see tomorrow a fake image or a deep fake, on how we can identify them. I think the technology also has catched up in terms of, like, identifying these models and deep fakes, and they can show it to you, like, hey, this is not a human generated image or a video. It was generated by a model used by who knows who in this space.
Congressman Obernolte suggests that we're trying to trademark, watermark, identify the AI-generated information, that we really should be identifying the authentic and original information, that we're, like, looking at it wrong. Do you agree?
Could be. But I think, like, look, the power of these models is so strong that I think it will be difficult for humans to try to identify all these things. So you need to come up with a technical solution and really filtering out the junk that exists. Because otherwise, they're so fast. The speed and scale of these models is so enormous that I think as a human, it's going to be impossible to do these things. So you have to come up with some kind of a technical solution. Now, as you know, it will be up to tech companies to adopt these mitigating actions. But I think they also acknowledge that a lot of these things will come at their cost. If a deepfake goes wrong or an image generator goes wrong, who to hold accountable?
Well, that's the issue. Who do you hold accountable? Yeah. All right, let's turn to the AI Expo, May 7th and 8th, Washington, D.C. You're taking over the whole convention center. Tell us about it.
Our goal as a project from the beginning has been to really bring the community of private sector and government in one place. Because as I mentioned from the beginning, is we lead as a country where these two communities are working hand in hand for, you know, our country's innovation and building the next generation of capabilities and technologies. And so we always were working on how do you bring these two communities at scale. And I thought nobody has ever organized an AI expo in Washington. There are many departments and agencies in Washington that would benefit by seeing, experiencing, and maybe eventually adopting these kind of technologies for their purposes and their mission. And so we have reserved one floor of the convention center. It's the size of a 4 football fields. And there are several elements to our AI expo. Number one is we are going to bring 100 plus exhibitors. This includes small, medium-sized, large tech companies. It includes government labs. It includes universities to showcase what they can do, not just with AI, but all the emerging tech. So that's one area. The second area of the expo is we have 3 demo stages where we will have these companies really showcase what they can do with AI, quantum, bio, you name it. To the visitors that are visiting Expo. We have a center stage there where we will bring, you know, CEOs from tech companies, cabinet members, decision makers, members of Congress to talk about these things. On the side of this, we're also organizing the Carter Exchange to honor the late Secretary Carter, where the conversation will be focused primarily on national security aspect of innovation and technology, which was really something that he has advocated for. And then lastly, we have 6 side rooms, and we're partnering with private sector companies, government, non-government organization to just organize a set of, like, conversations, fireside chats. I think in total, maybe about 40 of those in these side rooms where people can enjoy really some interesting conversations about AI safety, responsible use, the future of supercomputing, all conversations that I think aim to bring this community together. So we expect thousands of people over the course of 2 days.
Can anyone attend?
Anyone can attend.
You just register online,
just have to go
online,
to the website,
right?
expo.scsp.ai, where you can register and you can attend, and hopefully you can enjoy.
And you can podcast from there.
You can
podcast from there,
which hopefully we can get you to do it from there.
Yes, would be honored.
I also encourage, because Washington has 10 universities. So if we can get students to come out there and they can meet potential recruiters, We will have some of the major companies there recruiting people on site.
And universities.
And government.
Right, right.
And so this is a tremendous opportunity. It's in May. You're about to graduate. If you don't have a job, come at the AI Expo. Meet recruiters. We will have a pavilion for future recruitment. You will have so many opportunities to engage and listen to conversation and maybe land a job.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Also, learn what AI is doing.
100%.
How about that? I can't tell you how many people have asked me, how do I learn about AI? What do I do? Is there a class I can attend? Is there a special course? Because even in every conversation, I don't need to tell you, it's different for everyone, described in a different way. The experience is different.
Definitely.
And it keeps changing, to your point, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So are you saying that, let's just use ChatGPT because we started there. ChatGPT came out 2 years ago. Would you say it's advanced? Maybe you can't predict. Like 3 years, 5 years, 1 year? Because there's always these conversations about how far forward things are going. I find it remarkable from using a year ago to today.
No, I think you're absolutely right. All these models have gotten better and better. Like, remember, when they first started, they were not generating images. And then we had the next wave when they started generating images based on the prompts. I use them all the time. I think the best way for this is, for what purpose you want to use the AI. If you want to use AI to write performance evals, I think it's a tremendous aid. A lot of us have worked in government. You spend like hours writing performance evals for you, for your colleagues, for the people you supervise or they supervise you. You can generate these things so much easier and so fast and so much, much faster with these models. So it really depends. If you have little kids and you want to help them with math, Khan Academy has an amazing app called Kalingo, in which it helps personalized tutor for your kid, whether it's in math or chemistry or biology, but it will help your kid get to understand what 2+2 is. It will not give you an answer, but it will walk you through a logic of how you get to the 4 number. And so it just depends. I think we'll see a lot of personalized healthcare in this space. You'll see personalized education. You'll have now probably explosion of agents. They will do a specific task for you in this space. So it really just depends on what you will use it for. In terms of where you can learn a lot about these things, I think Coursera offers a lot of free courses online. I think even on YouTube, you have a lot of courses online that companies have actually produced to bring you up to speed what large language models are one-on-one. We went through a cyber education wave in both in government and outside, when you have to have a certificate every year in government to be eligible for these cyber technologies. I think we'll go through a wave of being educated in AI, what it does mean, what are the limitations, how it can help you do your job better. But I really recommend people just working with them.
Right.
I think the one way you build trust in these systems, whether or not you know they're not right 100%, is by trying them. And eventually, you will notice the errors they're making.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I use them all the time, as I said, and it helps me a lot in so many tasks.
Well, I can't thank you enough for being here and for all you're doing. I look forward to seeing you at the Expo. And for all of you listening, you got to join us there at the AI Expo, May 7 and 8, and right here in beautiful Washington, D.C., at the Convention Center. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tammy.
Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.